that the public receives the most accurate information possible about global warming. Over the past 20 years, the body of evidence Dr. Hansen and his colleagues began has only continued to grow. It recently resulted in a Nobel Prize-winning intergovernmental panel on climate change, which showed how rising concentrations of man-made pollutants are changing the climate of our planet. The debate is over. Global warming is here. Dr. Hansen was right. History has proven him to be a prophet. In his testimony before the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming last year, Dr. Hansen discussed future global warming projections and how we can begin to avert dangerous climate change. Dr. Hansen's message was clear: inaction has consequences. However, this is also a time of amazing opportunity. Climate change is a call to action. We have the opportunity to transform and grow our economy and move into an era of energy independence. New green collar jobs are already to be unleashed, and we must direct our investment in the new low carbon economy. This is why I have introduced the Investment in Climate Action and Protection Act, ICAP. It sets up a cap and invest system that is science-based, reducing emissions by 85% by 2050. ICAP is also consumer-focused and reinvests over half of the proceeds to American families through tax credits and rebates. 80% of Americans would receive benefits, and two-thirds of U.S. households would be fully compensated for any cost increases from the bill. And finally, ICAP is technology-driven and invests trillions of dollars in efficiency and clean energy technologies that will be essential to protect our planet from the climate threat Dr. Hansen warned us of 20 years ago. Last week, I heard from the people in Greensburg, Kansas, 95% of their community was destroyed by a tornado last year. They have seized this opportunity and are building a low-carbon community, incorporating energy-efficient designs and renewable energy sources. This small community faced this challenge and turned it into an opportunity to build with the future in mind. I hope that Greensburg, Kansas, serves as an example to us all of what is possible in the United States. Global warming is the greatest opportunity of our time to revolutionize our economy and to improve the quality of life for all Americans. More than 200 years ago, in my congressional district, Paul Revere rode out to Lexington and to Concord, saying that the British are coming. Dr. Hansen, 20 years ago, was a latter-day Paul Revere saying global warming is here and coming more intensely as each year goes by. Dr. Hansen is a latter-day climate change Paul Revere, warning us all of the dangers to the planet. History has proven him to be right, and it's our honor today on the 20th anniversary of that one to invite him here to address us. Welcome, Dr. Hansen.
Thanks very much. It's probably also worth pointing out that our actions to deal with climate change in the 20 years have really been pretty minuscule. And we're really running out of time. I think the next year or two is, that period is absolutely critical, or we will be passing tipping points with major consequences. I have a number of charts. It has become clear. I got out of this business of talking to Congress and the public after testimony in 1988 and 89, because I wanted to focus on science. And for 15 years, I did that. But a few years ago, I remember in 2004, I made the conscious decision that try to communicate, because this very large gap had developed between what was very clear scientifically, what was understood by the relevant scientific community, and what was known by the people who did this, and that's the public and policy. There is what became, has become clear is we have reached an emergency situation. Partly, it's hard for people to see it because weather variations are still much larger than the magnitude of global warming. And because of the inertia of the climate system, especially the inertia of the ocean, which is 4 kilometers deep, it takes a long time to respond to the change in atmospheric pressure, we have realized less than half of the eventual response to the gases that are already in the atmosphere. That creates a problem, because the climate system has tipping points. You can reach a point such that positive feedback, that means amplifying feedbacks, plus the unrealized warming that's in the pipeline, can carry the climate system dynamically with its own momentum through some large and often undesirable changes. A good example is ice sheet instability. If an ice sheet once becomes unstable, begins to disintegrate, slide into the ocean, well, by that time it's too late. Can't decrease the CO2 and affect that process. So we don't want to reach that sort of tipping point. But we're in danger of doing that. And in fact, what I can say with a very high degree of confidence, I would say more than 99.9% certain, that the safe level of CO2 is no more than 350 ppm, the long-term safe level. And we have already passed that level. Coincidentally, in 1988, CO2 was 350. It's now increased to 385. If we leave it there for a century or two, we are going to have undesirable consequences. On the other hand, the bright side is, as Mr. Markey said, Representative Markey, there are many benefits of solving the problem. And it is still possible, but I think just barely. And, you know, all of the nations had agreed in 1992 in the Framework Convention on Climate Change that we should avoid dangerous human behavior. The problem is we didn't define it. I think the most important criteria should include those which are irreversible. And especially that means extermination of animal and plant species, because that's irreversible on any time scale that we can think about. We are in the process of pushing off the planet polar and alpine species as the temperature lines move polar and up the mountain. But in addition, these temperature lines are moving on average at a rate of about 60 kilometers per decade. Some species cannot migrate that fast, and species are interdependent. So if we continue this rapid movement of climate zones, and even if it accelerates, if we follow business as usual, that movement actually accelerates, there is the potential for ecosystems to begin to collapse as some of the species go extinct. And that has happened. We know in the Earth's history there have been several times in every global warming, so several degrees Celsius, and more than half the species on the planet went extinct. And over time periods of hundreds of thousands of years, you've got new species. But that's a time scale which we can't even imagine. So we don't want to drive existing species to extinction. And as I say, there are a large number of reasons which allow us to conclude that the dangerous level is not more than 350 ppm. It may be the target level, may be less than that, but once we realize that it's no higher than 350 ppm, that tells us that we've got to have drastically different change of direction. And once we begin to do that, more empirical evidence accumulates, we can specify a number more precisely. But this tells us that the story is very different than we have been thinking up until the last few years. this Arctic sea ice is an example of a tipping point. And we have, unfortunately, passed the tipping point. We are going to lose all of the Arctic sea ice within the next 5 to 10 years. Already, this graph shows the amount of sea ice at the end of the warm season, early September. There's a function of time from the late 1970s to 2007. And it fluctuates from year to year depending on the weather. Exactly. But it was 8 million square kilometers in the late 1970s. Last year, it was only a bit more than 4 million square kilometers. So we lost almost half of the minimum seas. And the positive feedback is that as you lose the ice, then the dark ocean absorbs more sunlight, and that causes more warming. And because the planet is out of energy balance, there's more warming in the pipeline. And we have very good proof of the magnitude of the planet's energy imbalance. The single number characterizing the Earth's climate system, that's the most important in my opinion, is how far the planet is out of energy. There's more energy coming in from sunlight being absorbed by the planet than there is infrared heat radiation being radiated off because of the effect of greenhouse gases, which can attract that infrared radiation. And we now have the imbalance is someplace between half a watt and 1 watt per meter squared. The way we know that, well, that's what we get out of the climate models, but what really is important is what you can measure. And most of the energy associated with that imbalance has to be going into the big thermal reservoir, which is the ocean. The heat capacity of the atmosphere is really small. A small amount of the energy is going into melting the ice. We know how much that is, and how much gas is. But mostly it's going into the ocean. There's a paper published last week in Nature which did a much better job than previous studies in correcting for the various changes in instrumentation in the measurements of ocean temperature. And it shows that, indeed, the top 700 meters of the ocean is gaining heat at a rate of around 5 watts per meter squared. So the implication of that is, in the case of the Arctic sea ice, if we wanted the ice to stop melting further, we would need to restore the planet. The first order, we need to restore the planet's energy balance. That would mean we need to decrease the amount of greenhouse gases to something like, in the case of CO2, which is the dominant other things being equal, other gases staying constant, we would need to decrease it to 325 to 352 ppm. That's one measure of the CO2 amount that we would like to have in the atmosphere to keep our climate stable. Another one is the stability of ice sheets. The area on Greenland that melts, has surface melting during the summer, fluctuates from year to year. This is a graph of the area from the late 1970s when the satellites began to make the measurements until 2007. And this fluctuates it with good weather from year to year, but it has doubled. If you compare the late 1970s to the 2007 number, the area where the sun would melt is twice as large in 2007 as it was in the late 1970s. That melt water will find a low spot on the ice sheet and burrow a hole to the base of the ice sheet. And there it lubricates the base of the ice sheet and speeds up the flux of these giant icebergs to the ocean. The flux from these major ice streams has doubled in the last decade. And as a result, the ice sheet is now losing mass. And beginning about 4 years ago, 2002, 6 years ago, we began to have these spectacular measurements of the GRACE, the gravity satellite, which measures the gravitational field of the Earth with such a high precision that you can measure the mass of the Greenland ice sheet. So you can determine what the increased snowfall that we expect to accompany a warmer atmosphere or the increased melting is meaning out. And of course, we expect that the planet is warmer, ice is going to melt. Well, this confirms that's the case. Greenland gets heavier during the winter and then loses mass in the summer, but overall, its mass is declining. And last year, it lost 250 cubic kilometers of ice. It's I did not include a curve which shows what's happening this year. This year, last winter it was quite cold, and the sea ice did increase to a larger amount than it was the previous winter. But now, because that ice was mostly thin ice, single year ice, only of the order of 1 to 2 meters thick, rather than 5 meters thick, multi year ice, it is more vulnerable to melting, and already it has approximately caught up with last year's rate of melting in the Arctic. So if we wanted, that referred to the Arctic Sea ice, but with regard to the Greenland, if we wanted the ice sheet to be stable, clearly 385 ppm is too much. It's losing mass at a faster and faster rate. What I didn't include was the curve showing the rate at which this mass loss has been changing. It has been increasing rapidly over the last few years. Looking at the history of the Earth and how large ice sheets could be maintained at different levels of CO2 in the Earth's history tells us that probably CO2 should not be more than of the order of 250. Still, another criteria for establishing what a safe level of CO2 is the impact of global warming on the overturning circulation, the rising motion in the tropics and the subsidence in the subtropics. That causes the subtropics to be dry. That circulation expands at the point of this warming. And we can measure that it has expanded by about 4 degrees of latitude in the last few decades, which is affecting the southern United States. This is Lake Mead. Lake Powell is also only about half of it. In the Mediterranean region, where they had very extensive forest fires last summer, but in the southern hemisphere, Australia and southern Africa are affected by this expansion of the subtropical regions. And there's, again, because there's more warming in the pipeline due to the planetary energy amounts, this is going to only get worse if we stay at 385. Still another criteria are the glaciers, which are melting, the mountain glaciers, the alpine glaciers are melting fast all around the world. And these provide fresh water for hundreds of millions of people. Rivers that originate in the Himalayas, in the Rockies, in the Andes. These glaciers melt, once they're gone, you'll still get a large amount of fresh water in the spring as the snow, the winter snow melts. You get even larger amounts than after you get gone for floods. But once the snow melt is gone, then the summer and the fall, the rivers will become more affected. And this is going to be a big problem if we lose those glaciers. And at the rate we're going, those glaciers will only last a few more decades unless we can slow down and reverse the CO2 amount back toward this 350 ppm level or less. Still another criteria are the coral reefs, which are under stress for a number of different reasons, but two of the major reasons are the temperature increase associated with global warming of the surface ocean waters, but also the acidification of the ocean. As more CO2 is taken up by the ocean, it becomes more acid, and the skeleton and the shells that are calcium carbonate actually dissolve in this more acid water. So, again, and one third of the biology in the ocean is associated with this. So it's a huge impact on the ocean and the resources. ocean if we allow CO2 to exclude. That criterion, as well as the several others that I mentioned, all say that it we should be aiming for CO2 at no more than 2 miles. That's a fairly dramatic change of our thinking. And the problem is that when we put a pulse of CO2 into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, part of that disappears quite rapidly. Within 20 to 25 years, the pulse is down to 50%. Most of that being taken up by the ocean. But then the ocean resists taking up the rest of it because the CO2 in the ocean exerts a back pressure to come back out of the ocean. Until the CO2 forms carbonate sediments and is deposited on the ocean floor, the ocean cannot take up all of the CO2 again. After 1,000 years, about 1/5 of the CO2 is still in the atmosphere. So the upshot of that is that we cannot burn all of these fossil fuels. The purple parts of the oil, gas, and coal are what we've burned and put in the atmosphere already. If we put the remaining reserves of these fossil fuels in the atmosphere, we will be pushing the planet back to the ice-free stage, where as it existed when these gases were previous, when these fossil fuels were previously carbon dioxide. We simply can't put all of that back in the atmosphere. And that's just is not clear to policymakers. There are energy departments that just assume it's a God-given fact that we're going to burn all these fossil fuels and put the stuff back in. We can't do that. But practically, I don't see how we can stop putting the oil in the atmosphere because that's owned by Russia and Saudi Arabia. We can make our vehicles more efficient, but that oil is going to be used. It's going to get in the atmosphere. Cause of the 1,000-year lifetime, it doesn't really matter how fast we burn it. But what we could do is stop the coal. That is by far the largest potential source, and it is, we could decide we're only going to use coal at power plants where we capture the CO2 and sequester, or leave the coal in the ground and use renewable energies. Well, the other half of that diagram, and if we take what I think are the most realistic estimates for remaining reserves for oil and gas, oil is probably about half used. Most of the peak oil, most people believe that we're probably close to peak oil production, and will begin to decline in the next decade. In that case, if we phased out coal by 2030, then the peak CO2 would only be a bit more than 400 ppm. And, however, it would stay above 350 for a couple of centuries. We could get it down below 350 by means of improved forestry and agricultural practices, by reforestation of some regions which could use reforestation, and by agricultural practices such as no-till agriculture, but especially biochar, where you work charcoal. We could store 50 ppm and bring down CO2 beneath community. So it is technically feasible to solve this problem, but it requires that we phase out coal pretty quickly, because once we burn, if we burn that coal, put the CO2 in the atmosphere, practically we don't have any way to get it out other than maybe 50 ppm by the forestry. So it's crucial that we begin to, that we have a coal moratorium on coal-fired power plants unless they capture the CO2 and then phase it out in the next couple of decades. And I think, I didn't even include a bar on there for the unconventional fossil fuels, tar shale, tar sands, because we simply cannot use those unless we capture the CO2. And the way to avoid that is to have a carbon price, which would discourage the use of unconventional fossil fuels and trying to extract every last drop of oil from the lands and the Arctic, fishing wildlife energy, for example. And I think, this is I'm out of my range of expertise, but I think it's common sense that we have to be, we have to level with the public, that there has to be a price on carbon emissions. That's the only way we're going to begin to move toward a carbon-free economy, which we have to do. One thing that's become clear in the science over the last several years is because of this 1,000-year lifetime, you simply, it's not a question of reducing 20% or 40% or even 80%. We really have to go to renewable energy economy. And to do that, the way to do that in a way which is actually stimulates the economy is to have a carbon tax, simple carbon tax on coal, oil, and gas, which is very easy to apply, and then give all the money back on a per capita basis to the public. You can deposit it in your bank account. Peter Barnes has described essentially this way. That will be non-regressive. The poorer people will make sure that their tax is less than the dividend. And it will stimulate the economy because they'll want to buy fuel-efficient vehicles and appliances, and they will also have a big impact on lifestyle. Why do we, would affect agriculture, for example? It become, right now we're subsidizing fossil fuels and we're importing food from halfway around the world. Once you have a carbon tax, that will become less likely. And I think that way you would let the marketplace choose the winner rather than taking the money from carbon tax and Congress deciding where to spend it. I think it should be the marketplace that decides the winners. And I think this would be economically stimulative. There's one other thing which I think is absolutely essential, that the government has to play a leadership role, and I would hope that the next president would take it as his primary, one of his initial initiatives, and that is a national low-loss electric grid. We have the technology for a DC high-voltage grid, which could be buried so that there's not an issue about affecting the environment, this could be done in less than a decade. The backbone for this would be in place, and that would allow renewable energy to power our entire electric requirements, primarily, especially the solar energy. But again, you let the different renewables compete, but the wind that's available in different places, if you want to have a low-loss grid, that, I think, is essential. Otherwise, the renewables remain a small fraction rather than taking over. The bottom line is, it seems to me, that we have a basic conflict between fossil fuel specialists who would rather continue to reap the profits of fossil fuels, and as the prices go up, as the amount of fossil fuels decreases, the prices increase enough, it actually increases the magnitude of profit. But the question is, who is speaking for nature and for young people? Unfortunately, their influence on the political system does not at present match the influence of the professional interests. And we somehow have to change that. One comment I have made is that I think we need to draw attention to the leaders of fossil fuel industry. And I feel that they have had an impact on the discussion of this problem. The science has become clear what is needed, and yet the public is not aware of that, and it's largely because of fossil fuel, especially in this. who have supported what I would call misinformation. If we ask the National Academy of Sciences or the American Geophysical Union or the American Meteorological Society, they have put out very clear statements about the cause and effect relationship of the climate change and the fossil fuels. And yet, the public is not aware of that because of the support that's been given to contrarians who make it appear that there's still a scientific debate when there really isn't. And I think we should, and I say that if that causes, if that action causes the climate system to pass tipping points and to destroy nature as we know it, lead to instability of the ice sheet and extermination of the significant number of species, that those CEOs, and they're smart enough to know what they're doing, you can't expect the person in the street to have all the information available, but these CEOs do have interest. But at the same time, these CEOs are the potential people, the captains of industry, who could solve the problem. So I just want to draw attention to that. So I, in my opinion, I say if they don't change their tactics, that they're guilty of crimes against humanity. And they should be tried in one way or another, whether it ends up being just a court of public opinion, or whether there's really a legal way to do it. I'm not a lawyer, I can't say that. But they have got to change their approach if we're going to solve this problem on the time scale that we have to, which is the next few years.